This is Meet the Composer.
From WQXR's Q2 Music, this is Meet the Composer, the show that mines the brains of 21st century thinkers. I'm your host, Nadia Sirota. The first time I ever heard of composer John Luther Adams, I was at a percussion department recital, I think, in Paul Hall, which is one of the smaller concert halls at Juilliard. All of a sudden, I was taken over by what actually felt more like a physical sensation than sound, than music. So there were these four bass drums, each one of which was the size of like an 8-year-old, and they were placed in each corner of the small concert hall. They started kind of rumbling one at a time from each direction, and my first thought was that something very physical was happening, that I was experiencing an earthquake. What affected me most about this piece at the end of the day was that it wasn't just a trick. It wasn't just a cool sound that made me think about natural phenomena or anything. It was this very meticulously composed piece that was satisfying to listen to and had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I remember feeling so affected by this piece from moment to moment. This was music that was coming from a composer I had never heard of before. Who was John Luther Adams?
I've always felt that I could have my cake and eat it too, that music can be ravishingly beautiful or profoundly physical and still be intellectually airtight, rigorously conceived and executed. That's always seemed like a false dichotomy to me. Why couldn't music be smart and sound good?
Today, I sit down with 2014 Pulitzer Prize winner John Luther Adams, whose work has been described as haunted by silence. But it hasn't always been that way. John got kicked out of several high schools and was, in his own words, a know-it-all rebellious kid who started a rock band called Sloth. Nowadays, he's living and working as close as he can get to the edge of society in a cabin in Alaska. So how did he get there? How did a kid's obsession with noise morph into an obsession with wind and silence? Imagine 14-year-old John in a cover band in New Jersey, opening for acts like Buffalo Springfield and playing predominantly...
The Three B's.
Who are the Three B's?
The Beatles. Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. The Beach Boys. And the Birds.
Okay.
So we started out as cover bands, and I got bored with that, and so did my buddies, and... over time, we started trying our hand at songwriting, and I was a big fan of Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa, the teetotaling 1960s and 70s musician and polymath with wildly eccentric tastes spanning from rock to jazz to European modernism.
Anything gets me off as good as, you know, some contemporary classical pieces.
And on the back of Frank's early LPs, there would always be this intriguing little quote, "The present-day composer refuses to die," Edgar Varèse. And my little rock and roll buddies and I would read that and scratch our heads and wonder, who is this Varèse guy?
Right.
And one day my friend Dick Einhorn was rummaging through the record bins in a shop in the West Village, and came across this album with this mad scientist on the cover with a great shock of electrostatic graying hair and these bushy eyebrows and this stern countenance, and the title was The Music of Edgar Varèse, Volume 2. So he brought it home, and we quickly wore out the grooves. It just all sounds... like a bunch of noise to me. We hear this desert, this ocean, these forbidding mountains of sound, and I remember thinking, I'll never be able to know where I am in this. I don't know what to hang on to.
So your response to what is this music was just to immerse yourself
in it. Give
me
more.
Yeah.
Which has always been my response to any new experience. And I often encourage young musicians, especially young composers, you know, listen to everything you can get your ears on, especially the stuff you think you don't like. I started to realize, oh, okay, there's that repeated note with on the oboe, and okay, that's a landmark, I can grab onto that. Oh, and here's this place where there's sort of a tattoo figure with the snare drums and then these unison stabs in the rest of the percussion. Gradually, we began to learn how to listen to the Forbidding Deserts of Varese.
Did that affect the music you guys were making?
Oh, sure. It meant that the process that was already underway was just accelerated. We rapidly abandoned the 1-4-5 chords and the backbeat and the 4-bar phrases and started discovering Cage and Feldman and Nancaro and Paulina Laveros and Ruth Crawford and, you know, on and on. So thank you, Frank Zappa.
What you're hearing right now is an electronic piece by Frank Zappa called Love Story. Totally different vibe from the track we heard before. John was one of many people who used Zappa as a kind of gateway drug to the wild frontiers of modern classical music.
So you were listening to Varese and you found all this interesting music in the music store.
Yeah, and I started listening to these European composers. But I think early on I had this inclination toward these quirky, idiosyncratic Americans who were not really part of an identifiable sound or long historical tradition, but who shared a certain inquisitive spirit and a certain desire to reinvent, rediscover music for themselves from the ground up.
What was your first encounter with John Cage's music?
Harpsichord, you know, however you pronounce it, the music circus for harpsichords and computer-generated sounds. And I remember getting the LP from Nonesuch of that piece, and inside of it was several pages of computer printout. You know, this was, when was this, 1970, somewhere along in there. So just seeing computer paper and dots like that on the page was exciting, but it was the listener's score. It was your instructions for how you could play the volume, the stereo left and right, the bass,
the treble,
the different components of your stereo set to be actively part of shaping the experience of listening to the recording.
So here's a young Adams who's learned his craft in a kind of DIY way, who gets an invitation from Columbia University, the prestigious Ivy League, somewhat traditional choice. Enter John's friend, Dennis Keeley,
who was also a rock and roller.
Who basically grabs John by the scruff of the neck and directs him towards the first major detour.
Dennis said, "You're not going to Columbia." And said, "Oh, no." He said, "No, you're going to this new place in California." And I never listened to Dennis. I never took his advice. You know, I was always knew that I knew more than he did. But for some reason, I realized he was right about this. And so I found myself one fine afternoon in, oh, I guess it was 1971, the fall of 1971, walking into the studio of James Tenney.
James Tenney, electronic music pioneer, as yet unproven pedagogue, first year on the job, and a bit of a rebel.
Didn't know who he was, didn't know his music. And I started discovering, oh my God. What an amazing composer. how lucky was I? Here I was, knowing nothing, thinking I knew everything, walking into this studio of James Tenney at CalArts, and I must have launched into some tirade. And Jim sat very patiently and listened to this mouthy kid. And then I took a breath. He looked at me and asked in this wonderfully innocent way, "So, why are you here?" And so it began. Jim Tenney had my number from the get-go. He realized that nobody was going to teach me anything, that I had to feel that I was, yes, reinventing the wheel, rediscovering fire, like primitive man. But he had this uncanny knack for asking just the right gently pointed question at just the right moment. Again, I can't imagine what would have become of me had I not had that supreme good fortune. He played in the early ensembles of Steve Reich and Philip Glass. He worked with Cage. He knew everyone and had been all over the musical map in terms of his own curiosity as a composer. His music was amazing, mind-blowing. Jim was kind of reinventing himself right at that moment. Jim wasn't making electronic music, and I adopted the same posture and was interested in hearing new things with acoustic sounds. I had just left CalArts, hadn't yet gone to Alaska, and I would take long walks in the early morning and again at dusk, and I became captivated by this singer that I kept hearing deep in the woods, and I could never find the bird, but I couldn't get enough of the song. I started taking notes. The birds became my teachers after James Tenney. And the result was a series of pieces that I composed between 1974 and 79 called simply Songbird Songs.
Was the translation process between hearing this bird song that you just couldn't get enough of and constructing a narrative?
In working with the bird songs, I just try to take dictation. I try to listen carefully to the birds, where they are as they're singing, and write down what I hear. I'm not interested in accuracy, because if I were, I'd just make a recording and play the recording. I'm interested in what gets lost in translation, because after all, this is music, this is perhaps a language that we will never understand. Also, there weren't very many field recordings available in those days, but there were some, and I decided, no, I'm not going to use them. I really wanted to hear them and to learn them for myself. Now, that's actually very different from the way I work much of the time. Rather than working with very specific details of the music and then building the piece up, I usually sculpt away the whole field of sound, and I work with one big shape or image or color or atmosphere that I have in mind that I can't quite hear, but I want to hear. And try to hear that, sense that, write that down as clearly as I can, and then all the moment-to-moment details of the music follow.
Songbird Songs was a pretty seminal piece for John and proved itself as a kind of antecedent to a whole bunch of nature-inspired work. After the break, we'll hear how the landscape and severity of Alaska changed John's music forever. Stay tuned.